Thank you for tuning us in today. Today we're going to attempt to give you a little bit more of the lowdown on the bug itself. When we were talking topics for scheduling over the last couple of weeks, it got us into one of those who knows who kind of conversations. And let me tell you, if you've ever played the Kevin Bacon game, you know how closely connected we all are in the world, and one thing led to another, and one person in on our staff, Amelia, knew somebody who we're proud to be able to bring you, an infectious disease doctor from Boston who's on the who's in the forefront of the battleground right now. She's working with the coronavirus outbreak on the East Coast, and when we had mentioned to our two local doctors who've been coming in for the last couple of weeks that we had an infectious disease physician coming in, they both they had like childlike glee in their faces with knowing that they had the ability, they had all these questions to ask of somebody who was there. So they both readily agreed to come back and help put on this program and ask questions. So we're going to do things a little bit different today. We're going to basically, I'm going to start off by giving you some background information on the doctors themselves, and then I'm going to turn it over to the doctors so that they can talk amongst themselves about what their concerns are and what their issues are and what kind of things that they're seeing. So without further ado, I'll tell you that Dr. Laura Platt is on video conference and on the phone right now. She is a she's an infectious disease researcher at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She did tell us, if you're going to send in some questions, we will take questions and try and get them to the appropriate doctor for a response. But because of ethical and legal considerations, there are certain things that she can't specifically comment on. She can talk generally about what's going on the East Coast, but she can't specifically answer questions about what's going on in her hospital. So take that into consideration when you're crafting your question. Call 486-3181 if you have a question, or email us at thelowdown@kmxt.org. So in the room again, Dr. Steve Smith from Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center, and Evan Jones, Dr. Evan Jones from the Canna Medical Center. Thank you both for coming back in again today.
You're welcome.
So when we first started talking about this, I got to thinking that maybe, you know, what's the difference between an infectious disease doctor, a specialist in some other specialty, and how do you get to that place? If everybody wants to be a doctor when they grow up, how does somebody get to be an infectious disease doctor? You know, it seems like an odd choice, but how does somebody get to be an emergency room doctor? So I just kind of want to give people a little bit of background about who you are, what kind of training you had, and why you got into where you're at right now, and why you're so excited about infectious diseases on the local level. And then Dr. Platt, I'd like to do the same thing for you, is ask you, you know, if that was a conscious choice on your part to be an infectious disease doctor.
Yeah.
Even you want to start off, I mean, sure. When did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
That's a tough one to nail down, because pretty early on, I kind of thought that it would be, I think this could be a profession that I'd be good at. Life happens though. And I started coming down to Kodiak when I was a 17-year-old working over at Camp Woody. Growing up in Fairbanks, and kind of got sick of the mosquitoes in the summer and the 40 below during the winter, and thought Kodiak looks pretty nice, and moved down here and worked at the Kodiak Baptist Mission starting in 97. And I worked there for almost 10 years, working with kids, working in the office, even working maintenance, whatever needed to be done. And I'd always had in the back of my mind, I'd like to go to medical school. And so at the age of 32 or 33, I made the decision, if you're going to do this, you got to do it, or you got to put it behind you. And I thought, well, you know, on a lark, I just kind of went in and took the entrance exams and did pretty well. and just to see what they're like, and then applied and retook all of my pre-med requirements so that they're not 15 years old. And they actually let me into the University of Washington. So I entered the University of Washington as a first year as the oldest student in the entire medical school. At 35, it doesn't seem that old to me, but apparently that was the oldest at the time. Started my career a little bit later than most people with three kids and a wife and going, moving down to Seattle and working through the University of Washington system. And when I was done, there's really no other place I wanted to be. I wanted to be in Kodiak. And it kind of influenced my decision to be a family doc. It's hard to be a specialist in Kodiak. We do definitely do have some incredibly smart doctors here. But being a family doc allows that stretch to do lots of different things. There's some people who like to know a little bit about everything, and some people like to know everything about something, and I kind of like to know a little bit about everything, and I have a wide view that I'm jack of all trades but master of none. And in Kodiak, the docs here are Presbys. We're kind of, there's times where we have to be junior cardiologists, and we have to take on roles that a lot of big cities, the family docs would never take on, because they can easily send them to a specialist. ID is kind of a whole different world, because I don't even know that world. It's so specialized, but it opens up a whole new broad world of things that I don't really deal with at all. I call them and ask them, hey, I've got this bizarre thing going on, and it's not going to be in our favorite website for doctors, up to date or something like that. I need some real world experience of how to deal with this. And coronavirus certainly falls into that.
Yeah. Steve?
So I actually began my collegiate career as a microbiologist and then decided that I wanted to go into medicine. I'm feeling a little bit old, because I remember when Evan was asking about medicine, and then when he was a medical student. Mm-hmm. When he entered medical school, I'd already been in practice for 7 years. But I went to the University of Washington. I was an Idaho WAMI student, went through the University of Washington program, and then had, in our third years, we have different areas of medicine, you know, internal medicine. I actually did an infectious disease rotation down in Boise, Idaho at the VA hospital down there, but really found that I liked emergency medicine. And at that time, residency programs for emergency medicine were more big city related, and one of my mentors from Harborview down in Seattle said, go to a family practice residency where you're the only residents around. So I went to Southern Colorado. We were the only residents south of Denver. So on a daily basis, we were doing everything that Evan talked about. We were jack of all trades, but I really got into emergency medicine, and then I took an assignment with a company that was doing temporary docs here 30 years ago this summer in Kodiak, and I've never left.
Great. Dr. Platt, you are...
I similarly took a little bit of time deciding whether or not I wanted to go to medical school. I also thought about social work actually for a while, and generally have like a strong interest in working with underserved communities. And, you know, after some soul searching, went to medical school. I went to Duke, and while I was there, took a class in infectious diseases that I really enjoyed. I did an elective rotation, and I really enjoyed it. I sort of early on had an inkling that was something that appealed to me. And then in residency, you know, you sort of see all the fields of medicine, and every single time I saw a patient with an infectious process, I always thought that they were the most interesting patients. It tends to be, you know, a lot of international patients or a lot of travel-related infections, and I just sort of gravitated toward it. You know, it's interesting saying that being the jack of all trades, knowing a little bit about a lot of things or a lot about one thing. I think within internal medicine, people tend to think of infectious disease as being something where you actually really do have to know quite a broad range of information. You know, infections can sort of impact every organ in the body and can present in lots of different ways, and I really appreciated that. part about it. So after residency, came up to Boston. I'm now doing my fellowship in infectious diseases up here.
So what's involved? I mean, what is the day-to-day life of an infectious disease doctor like?
So there's some, it varies depending on where you practice and what you're doing. Last year I was doing a lot of inpatient infectious disease consultation. And so that means when there are patients who are admitted to the hospital who have some sort of infection at play, the primary team taking care of that patient will ask the infectious disease team to come in and sort of best identify what infection is going on and how to treat that infection. And then there's a lot of outpatient medicine, and that involves similarly, you know, being a consultant when there are questions that arise. It also involves being a primary care doctor for certain patients, in particular people who have HIV will often have their infectious disease doctor also serve as their primary care doctor. So that's another thing that I enjoy doing.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I'll turn it over to you. You know, I know you have all kinds of questions that you were wanting to direct to Dr. Platt. Fire away.
So, Dr. Platt, I think that to kind of start the ball rolling there, just can you give us kind of a brief what we know about the coronavirus today? You know, how infectious is it? Is it spread by aerosol or droplet? Once somebody's exposed to it, how soon after they're exposed do they become capable of shedding the virus, even if they're not symptomatic? So those are kind of some of the more science questions that I have. And then obviously we talk about, you know, the testing, and there's talk about new rapid tests and how well those are going to be. But I think, and we had our call-in show yesterday, I want to reemphasize to everybody listening that social distancing and keeping apart from everybody is still our best defense against this virus. And I'll let you take it from there. Thank you.
Yeah. So those are all great questions. You know, we're learning more about coronavirus every day. Early on, a lot of what we knew about coronavirus just depended on sort of, we know other viruses in the larger family of coronavirus, and not necessarily the COVID-19 virus that we're all thinking about now, but there's the common cold that is caused by some other types of coronaviruses, and then some more severe infections, SARS and MERS, that are caused by a totally different family of coronaviruses. And so we've been sort of trying to, as we learn more and more about the infection, trying to figure out, is this a virus that operates more like the common cold, or is this something that operates more like SARS and MERS? And you know, I think we've been increasingly finding that it kind of spans both realms. So I think similar to the coronaviruses that cause the common cold, this is something that we think is spread mostly through droplets. So meaning somebody will cough and it will sort of enter the air and, you know, can expand. You know, we think about 6 feet. That's why we get the 6 feet distance recommendation. It can land on surfaces and you can touch it and then touch your face or your mouth, and that can be another form of transmission. That's why we encourage people to wash their hands frequently. So that's sort of generally what we're thinking in terms of how the coronavirus spreads. In terms of how infectious it is, early on, I think there was a thought that maybe this wouldn't be as infectious. So with SARS and MERS, when somebody got exposed, they usually wouldn't start spreading the virus until they had symptoms, and that made it very easy to contain those infections and prevent sort of widespread community involvement. Early on, I think there was a hope that that would be that's how this coronavirus spreads, and now I think we're learning increasingly that after exposure, I think you can start shedding the virus within a few days and then not develop symptoms for a period of time or potentially not at all, and that makes it much harder to contain the spread.
So following up along those lines, I have people asking me all the time that they've read these articles where it'll stay on cardboard for 12 hours or on a metal surface for 24 hours. And I emphasize to them that it can be detected on those surfaces. But what's the chance of, if somebody drops off groceries and 12 hours later you put those away, what's the chance of actually becoming infected by something on the surface?
Yeah. So in the studies that people are talking about, they would, you know, put the virus on different surfaces and then over measured periods of time, see how much virus is around and what quantity of virus was around. Is this a infectious quantity. A lot of virus are a non-infectious quantity, so we can detect it, but it's not enough to actually cause an infection in anybody. And what we found is that across the board, the amount of virus that's around decreases over time. So the longer since the longer amount of time since the virus contacts that surface, and so when you interact with it, the lower chance you have of transmission. In general, we think that that's a minor contributor to spread. So most of it, we think, is coughing and, you know, your hand touching another doorknob, but not so much groceries. Metal surfaces tend to have a little bit longer. So steel, we think it could stay on that surface for a couple of days. Cardboard and paper, maybe at most one day, but it kind of depends on the amount of virus that gets on there to begin with. And in general, in all of these studies, routine cleaning is enough to remove the virus.
And what's the ideal temperature, moisture for something to stay there for a while? I kind of always felt like in Kodiak, we kind of have a cool, moist environment, so things can live on surfaces for a long time. But then I heard with this one, it actually likes a somewhat dry, warmer climate. Is there any truth to any of this?
I think we're still trying to figure that one out. I think initially there was a thought that maybe this is a virus that likes cold weather. We weren't seeing as much of it in the southern hemisphere, and I think it's just kind of too early to know that detail about it.
So in your patients out in Boston who you suspect have coronavirus, are you testing all of those patients, or are you doing your testing more for the because there's not enough testing only those critically ill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would love to be testing anybody who we think has the virus. Right now, we don't have the capacity to do that, although we're improving our capacity every day. So right now, testing is prioritized for patients who are ill enough to be in the emergency department or admitted to the hospital. Or sometimes we'll test patients who are not that ill, but for whom it really matters. You really want to know if they have coronavirus or not. So if they're a healthcare worker, they work in, you know, another congregate setting in a prison or in a shelter, in those situations, it's also important to know whether or not somebody has coronavirus and whether or not they could spread the disease to other people. Those are sort of the two primary categories for testing right now, either people who are quite sick or people who have the capacity to have a large impact if they're sick and they don't know it.
So currently here in Kodiak, we don't have a lot of tests either, and so we're being very selective about who we test. And it takes about 3 or 4 days to get results back. So the new test is going to come out. I think I heard that it was going to be checking for IgG antibodies, and it'll take 15 to 20 minutes to come pop positive rather than 3 or 4 days. How fast does somebody get infected and then have antibodies? So could somebody be infected and still not be positive on one of these rapid tests?
Absolutely. So the antibodies are things that develop, you know, there's two types of antibodies. There's IgM that develops over the course of, you know, a few days, and then there's IgG, and that tends to take longer. You know, we think maybe closer to 1 or 2 weeks to start showing up, and so certainly you can be infected and have virus detectable. You know, usually we check with the nasal swab. You can find virus on that nasal swab early on before the development of antibodies. So not a very sensitive test, meaning I think it's possible that people could not have that antibody response yet but still have the virus. I think the best use for that test is in combination with other bits of information to help you help sway you one way or another, but not as a standalone test. I don't think it's reliable.
And I think that's important. You know, everybody talks, oh, we're going to have a rapid test, but it doesn't rule out the coronavirus, and we still have to assume our social distancing. What I'm concerned about is we do a rapid test. It may not be really sensitive. Maybe it only picks up 65% of the time, or somebody hasn't developed the antibodies that the test is checking for, and then they go, oh, I'm okay, and they go back out in the general public and ignore our current recommendations.
So kind of moving a little forward, it takes things a while to reach Alaska. Sometimes when I was a kid, they used to actually truck TV up here, and it'd be about 2 or 3 weeks behind before it'd get broadcast. I still feel that way about a lot of the things that happen with infectious diseases too. I feel like we might be a week or two behind you guys. Are there things that you wish you had known a week or two ago that would be helpful for us?
I mean, I think looking back, it's kind of amazing to look back and think about how I was living my life a month ago, how I was talking to people even a few weeks ago, being much more cavalier about the risk of getting infected and the risk of infecting other people. And I think, you know, my attitude about social distancing has definitely changed a lot since I've seen coronavirus spread across the country and since I've seen it spread across Boston. And so I would say, you know, the cases that you see in the hospital reflect what was going on 2 weeks ago in terms of the amount of spread that was happening. You know, it takes a while from when you get exposed to when you get ill enough to present to the hospital. And so I would say, even if you look around and it seems like there's not a lot happening, not to take that as a sign of reassurance and to really learn from the mistakes of others and not, you know, do practice good social distancing, wash your hand, all of the advice that you've been hearing.
So one of the things that we've been hearing about is maybe effective or ineffective treatment regimens. If somebody has coronavirus, you know, the hydroxychloroquine and the azithromycin, even the antiviral remdesivir. What are you guys finding?
So right now there are a lot of hospitals that are doing good systematic studies of the IV antiviral remdesivir. It's too early to know if that's working, but I'm happy that people are studying it so that we can have a definitive answer and know what's going on with some certainty. In terms of hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, that's being studied a little bit less. You know, there's some anecdotal evidence that people feel like they take it and they get better. There's been some very small-scale studies that are published that are, I think, too small to really draw any conclusions from. So it's, you know, I think a reminder of how important it is to study things in a systematic way. Right now, we don't have enough information about that to recommend one way or another about whether or not it's helpful. We just don't know.
So right now, they're looking, I know you don't have a lot of information on it, but they're kind of looking at this combination of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, especially. Can you even postulate? We don't look at these two medications as being like, oh, these are good antivirals. I never would think along those lines. Can you even postulate how they might be effective or how they might be working?
So the azithromycin makes a little more sense. Azithromycin is an antibiotic usually, but we know that it has an anti-inflammatory effect. And so a lot of the problem that we see with coronavirus is that after you get exposed to the virus, your body starts responding to it, and then your immune system kind of goes out of control. You have a very inflammatory response, and that's where a lot of the lung damage that happens results from. And so there's a thought that maybe azithromycin, by reducing inflammation, would sort of mitigate that problem. In terms of how the hydroxychloroquine would directly affect coronavirus, I don't think we have as good of an understanding of that.
So why doesn't prednisone, I mean, we think of if somebody's really inflamed, we would do, let's throw some prednisone at them. It's, you know, just an oral steroid that's commonly used. And so let's dampen down the immune system that way. Is that an overkill with dampening down the immune system? Is that what they think is the issue?
Yeah. So, well, the challenge with prednisone, this is the thing, you know, in the past when there have been other viruses that are happening, people have looked at prednisone with a lot of excitement. I think maybe similarly to how people are looking at hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin right now, saying, you know, this seems in some people to have a good effect, let's use it. And as it turns out, I think with prednisone, you know, it really impairs your body's ability to fight a virus or bacteria, and it's really only effective when you have antibiotics or antivirals on board that are, you know, taking care of the virus, and then it can control the immune system. So I think it's something that, you know, previously had been used on anecdotal evidence alone or on, you know, small-scale observations. And we looked at it on a large scale. We realized it was not not effective and, in fact, was probably harmful.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. So if you're consulted on a patient, would you put them on hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think if I was consulted on a patient who was at low risk for toxicities related to them, so certainly we want to look at people's heart function before we do it, and they seemed like they were not doing quite well, and they, for any other reason, couldn't be getting a medication through a trial where we can really make sure that what we're doing is helpful, then I might consider it. But I certainly wouldn't use it for people who are well and in the outpatient setting right now. I'd have hesitation. I think they'd have to not be able to be a part of a bigger trial and not be well enough to be at home. And then I might consider it.
So your advice for all of us as primary care frontline providers is talk to a specialist before we just randomly put people on antibiotics, because I think that's going to be in our clinics. Mm-hmm. We're trying to stay abreast of all this, but I think about other locations in the country where they have urgent care type of settings where we see not good antimicrobial stewardship always.
Hopefully we'll know more about what's effective and what's not effective soon, and we'll be able to provide better guidance. But right now, I think it's really appealing to be able to do something when somebody comes into your urgent care center or your emergency department and you find out that they have coronavirus. I think everybody's impulse would be to want to do something to help. And I would just caution that until we really know what we're doing, it's possible that that medication prescription may actually cause more harm than good.
Let's talk about vulnerable populations for a second here. Obviously, this is not across all age ranges. Maybe I've falsely assured parents, but I've told them that, just influenza A might be harder on your kids than this disease. Why are people, especially 65 or older, really, in their 80s, so hard hit by this disease?
There's a lot of speculation about why that might be. The particular part of the body that the coronavirus attaches to, the receptor, is the ACE2 receptor, and there's the thought that expression of ACE2 may be higher in older adults, in particular older adults who have underlying cardiac disease. So there's a thought that that may be part of what mediates people's susceptibility to such severe presentations, but really we don't know yet.
And what about it kind of follows along those same lines, people with diabetes, people with hypertension. Mm-hmm. Is it because the elevated ACE2 receptors in people with hypertension
I think that's our best guess so far, but I think we'll certainly learn more as time goes on.
Any recommendations for us dealing with these populations besides protect them?
Yeah, and other people who are around them encourage them to protect them as well. So again, harping back on the importance of social distancing and washing your hands. And the thing that I would say is that the time course that we've seen in people's illness is often that somebody will be exposed. They may have sort of a viral syndrome that looks not unlike influenza for a period of time. Either a stuffy nose, a sore throat, some fevers and chills and sore muscles, and then people can quickly decline into severe shortness of breath and requiring, ventilatory support. And so I think the other guidance that I would say is that for people who are at higher risk of not doing well, that they be really attentive to their symptoms and that they let you know if they feel like they're getting worse.
So going back to testing a little bit, there's been a couple different philosophies about this. I've heard some mm-hmm. docs in Seattle feeling like, why are we testing? We should be testing people who are symptomatic and telling people to socially isolate no matter how they feel, because there is the asymptomatic population. And other people, such as the Korea model, where they tested as many people as they possibly could. And in an ideal world, what would you like to see done for testing?
In an ideal world, I think you should test everybody. You should find out who's infected and needs treatment, who's infected and asymptomatic and should be kept separate from other people, who's recovered and who's at risk of becoming infected. And I think you can sort of tailor your interventions depending on where somebody is on that spectrum. Unfortunately, right now, we don't have that, the capacity to test everybody. And so we're left with this really blunt recommendation of just encouraging everybody to behave as if they were infected and infectious, and I think that that's you know, the best that we can do with our current testing capabilities. But in an ideal world, I think we would have tested everybody, and we would have identified disease earlier on. We would have separated people who were infected earlier on and really decreased the spread to vulnerable people.
Can we talk about herd immunity for a few minutes there? I mean, can we hold this at bay long enough to wait for a vaccination, or do you feel like this is going to go through the country and a lot of people are going to be immune from it just because they catch the disease?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I think the earliest projected date of when we would have a vaccine that would be, you know, scalable to the larger population wouldn't be until 2021. And so I think the ideal would be to slow the spread right now so that the influx into hospitals is something that's at a manageable pace. But I wouldn't think that we can, you know, rely on a vaccine alone to get us there. I think we probably need to slow the spread through other mechanisms first. And it's possible that we'll reach the, you know, saturation point of herd immunity. People quote anywhere between 40% and 70% of the population when that many people have been infected, that you no longer have rapid transmission between one group to another. I think the amount of time that it takes to get there depends on how good we are at just slowing the spread of the virus. And I don't think it's in our best interest to just really quickly get to 40% or 70%.
I think Dr. Platt brings out a good point, taking off on what Evan said there, that we have to still assume that everybody, every one of us is infectious until proven otherwise. And so we should practice that social distancing. And that the longer we can delay seeing it here, the more chance that we can benefit from what's happening down below in Boston and elsewhere. And that also, the longer we can delay the spread between individuals, gives our researchers more chance to develop antivirals that'll work, you know, maybe a vaccine. So, it seems like I keep harping on this, but I hear people go, well, I think these people are okay, so we can get together with them. And I'm like, you know, you really have to consider that everybody is infectious, just approach it that way, and maybe we can keep our distance and slow this down.
So we don't want to hog all the questions, so we're going to turn to listener questions at this point. And so we had somebody call in and ask about these people who don't show any symptoms. How long can they spread it after exposure? Somebody who really doesn't have symptoms. We've seen some people who have viral shedding as long as 37 days after exposure. What about the people who aren't really showing any symptoms at all? How long can they spread this virus?
So we're still learning more and more about that. Certainly people who have severe disease, people who do show symptoms and are sick enough to be in the hospital or in the intensive care unit, tend to spread longer than people who have mild disease. But, you know, there are those exception cases where people spread before they have any symptoms at all, or continue to spread for a while, or shed virus for a while after recovering. And I don't think we're really going to know how long asymptomatic people shed for until we have the ability to really test people.
All right.
I don't think we have the capacity to answer that question.
So another follow-up question that's kind of impossible to answer, but we'll ask it anyway. So how much of the spread of COVID do you think is attributable to people who have no symptoms?
That's a good question. I mean, I think a fair amount of the spread of virus is probably attributable to either people who have mild symptoms and write it off as maybe this is just my routine allergy happening, or people who are what we call pre-symptomatic. So they start developing symptoms in a few days. But before the development of symptoms, they're already shedding virus. And I think that group, we're increasingly seeing as a